Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the Drill Down. We've got the business stories behind Stocks on the Move. I'm Corey Johnson with episode number 245. Well, just ahead, we found some things you probably didn't know about Donald J. Trump Media. And how committed is Tesla to the low-cost vehicle? And a fascinating conversation with the Upwork CEO, Hayden Brown. But first, it's sponsor time.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Braintrust, a global talent network that matches highly skilled technical freelancers with the world's most reputable brands. Braintrust has helped clients like Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Porsche, Under Armour, and more build agile tech teams fast at a fraction of the cost. Visit Braintrust.com, that's BRAINTRUST.com to learn more and get 20% off when you use our link, Braintrust.com/drilldown.
I'm Futurum's Chief Market Strategist, Corey Johnson. We're here with the latest episode of The Drill Down, where we explain the business stories about some stocks in the move. Joining me on the mic today, Ben Wilson. Glad to have you, Ben.
Happy to be here as always. Excited to hear some more business stories.
Huh, imagine that.
I don't know, what a surprise. Speaking of surprises, Corey, what stocks are you drilling down on today?
Let's go to Take Two Interactive.
Take Two Interactive, friend of the show. We've had some great interviews with them, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, Strauss Zelnick, CEO, friend of the show. We love him.
Fantastic guy. Seems like it, at least to me. Trades with the ticker TTWO with a market cap of about $26 billion. Shares were flat in the last week, but for the last 12 months, shares are up 27%. So what's the latest story with Take Two?
So, and I mentioned that we like Strauss Zelnick because he was kind enough to come on the show, and I've interviewed him often over the years, but it doesn't mean we won't cover the company in a fair way and even tough way. But they announced an interesting thing here with an acquisition of a company called Gearbox Entertainment that they paid $460 million in stock to acquire, an all-stock deal. So not a huge thing for Take-Two, which is a $25 billion market cap company, although it was a pretty good deal. Earlier valuations of Gearbox were as much as $1.3 billion. So for them to pay less than $500 million to acquire it is a pretty good deal. And the acquisition gives them, you know, more things to diversify away from Grand Theft Auto, which is a good thing for this company. Just like their acquisition of Zynga has helped them, particularly in mobile games. But with Gearbox, they get Borderlands and Brothers in Arms, so some diversification, some growth. But this is still, in a lot of ways, a Grand Theft Auto story. GTA, we don't know exactly what it was as a percentage of sales in the last year. Their 10K hasn't come out, but the previous for fiscal year 2023, it was 14.6% of revenues, just that one game. And even the GTA, the Grand Theft Auto trailers, have had a positive effect on the sales of the old versions of GTA, trailers for GTA 6, which looks super cool. To me, that's my opinion on that. But nonetheless, even those trailers coming out have had an effect on sales, which is something Strauss Zelnick talked about in the last quarterly conference call, that it's actually boosting GTA 5 numbers.
Look, we're really gratified that the announcement of the trailer was a huge event online. And then the trailer debut between YouTube and other marketing partners set a record for a video debut. So we couldn't be happier or more excited by the initial trailer. And I do think that excitement around GTA 6 has had halo effect on the entire franchise. You know, we've now sold in 195 million units of GTA 5, and GTA Online continues to perform above our expectations. So I do think all things GTA, you know, lead to more excitement.
So, Ben, I was a big fan of the earlier GTA. I deciding I was going to have a life and a career, I had to get away from those games. But I don't know if it sucked you in.
Not so much the games, but it is fascinating to see the impact these trailers have to the entire culture, really.
Yeah, who knew?
Corey, what's your next drill down?
Let's look at Tesla.
Tesla should be a lot of fun there. Trades with the ticker TSLA with a market cap of about $515 billion. Shares are down 6% this last week, but for the last 12 months, shares are still down 12%. So what's going on
Tesla,
with Tesla?
Not a friend of the show. Elon Musk, not a friend of the show. Elon got
maybe
mad
someday,
money.
Right? Maybe someday he'll come on the show.
Who knows? He was really ticked off, I think, when I had some critical reports of the company in my days at Bloomberg, so much so that he actually blocked me on Twitter. Mm. He has, interestingly, unblocked me in the last couple of months. So hope springs new. I don't know. forgiving guy, Elon Musk, so kind of him. But the stock dove briefly on Friday after Reuters reported that the company wouldn't build their lower priced all-electric vehicle that Wall Street is calling a Model 2. The Tesla shares dropped about 6% really quickly when that news came out in the wee hours here in California. And then he took to Twitter, to X, sorry, no longer Twitter, to deny the report, saying Reuters is lying again. But instead of building the Model 2, the Reuters report suggests they're going to focus on producing self-driving robo-taxis. And that decision had been made in February. So I'm going to keep an eye on this one because there have been other reports about conflict within the company about where to go on this. Now, this comes on the heels of some disappointing numbers for Tesla. Ben, you alluded to the stock performance and how poorly the stock has done in a year when the S&P 500 has been going straight up. The stock, you know, as you mentioned, losing ground in the last year. But Tesla made 433,000 vehicles in the first quarter, which would have been great for them once upon a time. But that was actually down on a year-over-year basis. And maybe more disconcerting, their inventory increased by about 46,000 vehicles. Now, the Tesla bulls said, oh, there were some one-time production problems in their Fremont, California factory and the Red Sea shipping delays, and they lost some production in Germany after a fire that they say was arson. But I did a hit on Schwab Network yesterday with Steve Wesley, who was once a board member there, a venture capitalist. And you know, he was saying the low-cost car is the most important thing that they've got going. But I took issue with this notion that deliveries, that the sales numbers were bad because of production problems, because they overproduced in the quarter. They've never had a big gap between production and sales. And that suggests to me that the demand is just drying up there. All the more reason they need that low-cost car, which could turn around the sales slump in ways that the Cybertruck did not. Here's what Elon Musk had to say in the last conference call about that low-cost vehicle.
And we're very far along on our next-generation low-cost vehicle. This is an earnings call, not a product announcement. So there'll no doubt be many questions that try to ask us about new products coming. But we reserve product announcements for product announcements, not earnings calls. So. But we're very excited about this, and this is really going to be profound, not just in the design of the vehicle itself, but in the design of the manufacturing system. This is a revolutionary manufacturing system, significantly, you know, far more advanced than any other automotive manufacturing system in the world, like by a significant margin. Several years ago, I said that perhaps the most important competitive characteristic of Tesla in the future will be manufacturing technology. And you will really see that come to bear with our next-gen vehicle.
So while that sounds like commitments galore from Tesla, we've heard from Tesla for years about things that don't come to fruition anywhere near on time. So I'm going to still keep this one, even despite its denials, Ben, in the who knows category.
Corey, what's your next drill down?
Let's do this a little differently. Let's hear from the largest shareholder of our next company.
They figure the way they're going to stop us is by using what's called warfare. And that's what it is. This is warfare for the law. And we can't let it happen. We can't let it happen. Our country is going to hell. And they come after Donald Trump, weaponizing the Justice Department, weaponizing the FBI. We can't let this continue to go on because it's ripping our country to shreds.
You know, I know who that is. The company, Trump Media and Technology Group, and with a SPAC IPO now trades with the ticker DJT, has a market cap of about $5.7 billion. shares were down about 15% in the last week. But for the last 12 months, shares are up 211%. So what's the story with Trump media and technology?
Yeah, the last thing to trade under the ticker, DJT, also had the same guy as its largest shareholder, and it went bankrupt. But here they are reviving the ticker, DJT. Truth Social, there's been a lot of ink spilled on this one, but we got a read request asking if we would take a look at it. So I took a look, and it's really interesting. The other thing I did, Ben, you may be amused, is I signed up for Truth Social.
Oh,
preparing
fun.
This report. The sign-up page advertises, says it encourages an open, free, and honest global conversation without discriminating on the basis of political ideology. But as I scanned through Truth Social, I seem to see just one political ideology, as you might expect. The confirmation email I received signing up welcomed me as a truth-sayer. But I found that this thing is just, it's got issues. It's not ready for prime time. I mean, you know, classic example, the Donald J. Trump page, that looks kind of like a Twitter page or an X page, if you will. If you click on the link to take him to his website, the link doesn't even work. So even on that page, it's got issues. And that's after spending $9.7 million in R&D last year on top of $13.6 million the year before. And simple things like links don't work. So as I went through the financial documents, one of the amazing things to me was the $8.9 million spent last year in general and administrative costs. Now, they don't list how many employees they have, but G&A is personnel, salaries, benefits, and stock comp for the executive team. So it's not the R&D team. It's not the sales team, just the executives. The idea that they had to spend $8.9 million is kind of amazing. Now, that'll include outside legal, third-party consulting and things like that, furniture, I guess, but pretty amazing expenditures. And so when you dig a little deeper into financial documents, you find out that this little company with not much by way of revenues, what was it, $4.1 million in revenues, is spending a lot of money on executive salaries and consultants. The CEO is going to take, with salary and retention bonuses, $1.35 million. That's Devin Nunes, former congressman from California. Two of the initial founders are going to take about $1 million of the company. Dan Scavino, the political consultant, $840,000 plus expenses, plus a $2.2 million loan. And other mystery execs, we don't know who, got $640,000 in retention bonuses, as if those high salaries weren't enough to retain them. And in an interesting twist, Donald Trump himself was out, President Trump, talking about Truth Social and suggesting what it's such a strong company, which some have suggested would run afoul of the Securities and Exchange Commission for promoting this if these promotional things are untrue. He wrote on Truth Social, all the competitors of Truth Social, especially those in the radical left Democrat Party, are failing at every level. Like to use their vaunted disinformation machine to try to convince people it's not as easy to do. With Truth Social is not a big deal. And then talks about how it has over $200 million in cash and zero debt, which is true. But in terms of revenues, it doesn't have that. And it lost $58 million last year. Some of those costs will go away in subsequent years, but interest expense in particular, since they have so much cash now. But nonetheless, a struggling business, the operating business losing $16 million last year, that $200 million will go away real fast with operating losses like that. So an interesting look and an interesting company, Ben. All right, up next, our guest, Upwork CEO Hayden Brown. Fascinating company at a fascinating time when tech hiring is struggling. Upwork's doing all right in its gig work. They don't like that phrase, but Their smaller jobs are doing well. Their corporate work, we're going to find out about how that's all going from the CEO, Hayden Brown, right after this.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Era. Never miss another critical event or insight ever. With Era, customize your company watch list and track key events, mentions, filings, and more. All within an easy-to-use, customizable interface. That's Era, AIERA.com.
Welcome back to the Drill Down podcast. We're joined right now by the CEO of Upwork, Hayden Brown, joining us from Silicon Valley. Glad to have you.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so interested in this conversation because I've been thinking a lot, preparing for this, about the very essence of hiring and hiring for work. And I'm surrounded here at Shack 15 in the Ferry Building by all these startups who are growing and quite often hiring. I don't really get to hear them firing much, but the nature of how we find the people to work with, such a consequential decision in people's lives and such a weird business. When you came to start looking at Upwork and how do you... What are your big takeaways on how it works?
You know, I think one of the biggest takeaways, Corey, is the old system is totally broken. You mentioned that it's a high stakes process, and it is. And frankly, it doesn't have to be. I think that's one of the big insights that animates our business, which is trying to diffuse and take the stress and the pain out of what too often is a high stakes decision and goes wrong. And instead giving clients and talent a different way of operating their businesses, which is much lower stakes. Like you can ramp up or ramp down at a whim as needed, which every business needs that type of flexibility today. You can contract to hire people. So you test out, you know, the talent on the go and you find out, are they the right ones for you? And are they, and similarly, you know, do they want to work with your business? And it's a much more dynamic working model that fits with how businesses need to operate today, and frankly also fits with how talent want to work today, because talent so often increasingly actually want more flexibility, more freedom, more choice in terms of who they're working with, how they're working, where they're working, et cetera. And so I think a lot of the old hiring model is broken and dead, and we're seeing, you know, a real shift around how people want to work, and that's the market that we serve.
It's super interesting because it's employment is so much more dynamic than maybe it's because I'm old or not clever, but I at a certain point, you know, you imagine you get a job and you've got a job and maybe you change your job a couple times in your life. And it's not what the world is like. It's not what employment is like in America.
No, it's not that way anymore. I was talking to somebody yesterday.
Hasn't been that way for decades.
It's been that way for a long time. I think that's the funny, the myth and the reality are like in totally different places. You know, this example of somebody yesterday, you know, she's writing a book. She's running a podcast. She is consulting by training people, you know, in her industry all the time, like paid training. So her career is so multifaceted. And this is just an example of how people are building their careers today, which is just very much more dynamic. And what we hear when we talk to freelancers, you know, what we've seen in our research is freelancing has been a growing trend. You know, 64 million Americans are freelancing today. It's contributing more than $1 trillion to the U.S. economy. And as people are building these careers, they're doing it by choice, not out of necessity. And they're doing it because it actually gives them more security. They do not want to be tied to a single employer who can cut them, you know, the minute the economy goes bad or the minute, you know, something in the business changes. These individuals are saying, look, I want to have this portfolio career where I'm in control. I decide and work on my terms, and having these kind of different, pots on the fire, like gives me different avenues for earning. It actually is also very stimulating for me in terms of giving me a lot of different ways that I'm learning and earning, you know, at the same time. And so that's really what the modern career is about. It's not what you and I think of in terms of like the single track, you know, one career, one job, one employer for life.
When I think of your business, I think of it really as a marketplace, obviously, but as a, you know, my experience of marketplaces is primarily of a particular marketplace, which is the trading of stocks on New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ. But the buyer and the seller, in this case, the buyer is the corporate and the seller is the worker. But marketplace businesses are great, but really challenging because it's hard to control either aspect of that. You guys have simplified your model a lot in the last year by sort of going to a single tier of what your take is. Explain that, how that works for the uninitiated, and then maybe why you made that change.
Sure. You know, one distinction I make about our marketplace, which is, it's an incredibly powerful model, is it's not just transactional. You know, people aren't just coming here for the match. They actually stay through the entire course of the project execution, getting paid, getting a feedback score, and then that powers our entire flywheel, which I think is a really important distinction about how our business works and how it drives scale and value. In terms of the pricing change that you alluded to, for the last many number of years, we had a tiered pricing structure on the talent side, which is the predominant way that we earn our revenue, such that as talent earned more in a given relationship with a client, they had a sliding scale of fees that would get cheaper over time as they hit certain earning milestones. And so they would go from a 20% fee to us for the first $500 of earning in that relationship, down to a 5% fee once they cross a $10,000 earning milestone. And that had very good and bad things to it in terms of, you know, rewarding long-term relationships, which, as I mentioned, is the bread and butter of what we do at Upwork, makes us very unique. But also it created a lot of headwinds for us from a take rate perspective, as, you know, those long-term relationships actually, you know, degraded our take rate over time. And also importantly, it actually changed the dynamics around how talent bid for work by increasing the amount that they would price projects at, because they were pricing in that full 20% fee for the first only $500 of a project. And if you think about it, the average spend on our platform is thousands of dollars per project. So prices were kind of overinflated relative to what they needed to be, just given that headline fee for the first $500. So the change we made was to simplify our fee structure, take away the tiered services structure, and go to a flat 10% fee, which means talent can now reprice to that fee level, bringing down prices and unlocking more demand in the ecosystem that's more in line with that new pricing structure.
Yeah, and I perhaps I should have led with this. Full disclosure that I helped work at a company called Brain Trust that is a marketplace. It's a talent marketplace focused on tech, more focused on tech, I think, at least in its early days, and more focused on Upwork, which is much broader than that. But one of the issues that came up when the business was getting started was a lot of freelancers didn't even know. They were surprised what their take was at the end of the day. Like my teenagers when they get their first paycheck, when they're like, "Dad, who is FICA and why is she taking so much of my paycheck?" You know?
Yeah. And I think, you know, we work really hard to make sure there's like full transparency on our platform around fees and around bidding and around negotiation of rates, because what we view as our role is really bringing kind of equal opportunity to clients and talents who come together, match on our platform, negotiate those fees and those rates. And talent actually know very well what their take home rate is going to be, you know, after all those fees are applied. However, they don't know.
I mean, maybe they do now with your one rate.
What the project or the relationship is going to be. Because up front, as I mentioned, the value of our model is also this kind of like test and learn dynamic where they might say, "Hey, this was great, but I'm out of here because, like, you know, the project's over," or, you know, "it turns out your culture is really not a great fit with my working style," and vice versa. The client might say, "Hey, you know, we're done at phase one, or we want to perpetuate this thing for years." So there is some level of uncertainty in terms of duration, not in terms of, you know, what the pricing is going to be. And that duration uncertainty is where people were pricing in that full 20% fee up front. And now that we have a simplified fee structure, they don't need to worry about that and kind of try to guesstimate, you know, is this going to be a $5,000 project or a $500,000 project?
Talk to me about, you made some changes in the way that, I should back up. You've got two reporting structures. This is the financial modeling geek in me. You've got two sort of cohorts of revenue in basically big corporates and then smaller companies. What's the distinguishment there?
Yeah, I mean, we serve the full continuum from very small businesses through, you know, a large portion of the F100, Fortune 100 companies. And we have kind of two models, I think you're referring to, for serving those businesses.
Marketplace and enterprise.
Enterprise. Yeah. The enterprise product, which is really designed for large companies working at scale, very programmatically, you know, thousands of hires, millions of dollars of spend on our platform. That product has a subscription fee, which our marketplace product does not, and a higher take rate to it, depending on which product companies are buying in that tier. There's a classification service they can buy, which is a higher price take rate. And then there's also kind of enterprise standard, which doesn't have classification services. So companies that are buying that product from us are getting both more product and more services, depending on what they're opting into there. We also have a managed services product where we are doing, you know, all of the soup to nuts hiring and management of the on behalf of those clients.
So the enterprise business is about an eighth, if you will, maybe it's a little more than that of the business. But you changed the way you categorize that. And why was that? It's a minor thing, but for me staring at my Excel spreadsheet at the company, I'm like, wait a minute. Oh, damn it. These numbers only go back for 6 quarters. And of course, I typed them all in wrong because I go through every SEC filing when I'm building my models.
We're just going to simplify and not confuse, but we have gotten some questions on this. And the simple fact is, we shifted at the beginning of last year to a business unit structure for managing the business. We now have Zoe Diamati, who is our GM of enterprise, managing the full enterprise business. And that includes all of the products and services that we sell to enterprise customers, both the managed services business that I mentioned, and enterprise standard, enterprise compliance, et cetera. And many of our customers buy across that suite. So they might be enterprise compliance customers that also are buying managed services contracts. So because of that management structure and the way we manage that internally, we also wanted to reflect that in terms of our external reporting. So our external reporting just now matches how we measure that business internally, but there's no other changes in terms of what that entails. It was just simply kind of rolling it up in the same way that we look at it internally.
Yeah, I was trying to think about why, how your business works and who the customers are that reflect that. And you know, you've had, you know, decent double digit growth in the in the marketplace business, but the enterprise business is flat to shrinking. And I wonder what that reflects. I can guess, but you actually know. That's why we have you on.
I can tell you about that. So, you know, we did see a slowdown in that business last year in particular, which was really related to the macro economy. We saw, like so many other businesses, enterprise companies significantly belt tightening, really looking at where they're spending and just pulling back across the board, not specific to their upward programs in terms of hiring, in terms of programmatic spend, et cetera. So as companies were going through that reset, which was particularly notable kind of in Q1 and that timeframe kind of early last year, we did see our enterprise business kind of resetting to what was going on in the broader ecosystem. Since then, we have started to see, you know, more of that acceleration. We saw really notable land performance from our team in Q4. We've seen double the performance of our reps in terms of productivity on the land side. And this year is really about driving the expand side as well. You know, with this new leader in place, we have been really zeroing in on land and expand productivity, with land kind of taking the lead earlier and expand activity, I think, coming into the picture more this year, as we will see growth and acceleration in that business in 2024 and into 2025.
I didn't watch other interviews that you've done before we talked. I mentioned you, I listened to some other conference calls and investor presentations, but it occurred to me that an unprepared television broadcaster, like I once was, would just ask you questions about the recent labor statistics. But I do imagine that there is a real tight correlation to what's happening in your business and the underlying labor markets.
You know, there can be, and there also is some separation, because I think, you know, what we see specific to our sector is a little bit of a unique microcosm versus what gets reported, you know, in those very high level aggregated statistics.
Because it's tech or largely tech, because it's.
It's less about being tech, but, you know, we offer, you know, a flexible dynamic model across 125 categories of work for a set of companies that are working in this new and much more cutting edge way. And so, you know, in some ways, I think we've seen the business be a leading indicator ahead of certain labor market trends. At other places, it's kind of been in line with. I don't think it's been consistently, you know, one or the other. But our main focus has really been on driving our performance of this business, actually irrespective of and in spite of whatever else is going on in the macro. And I think that's what we've really started to demonstrate in the last year and a half in particular, as we have had success with things like our ads and monetization program, repricing the product, like all of these things, which are actually giving us dials and levers to make sure that our business is performing the way we want it to and as we predict it to, despite, you know, macro noise, which can happen, you know, in a lot of different ways and flavors. And I think that is an important story for this company.
Yeah, it's like, so I told my little kids, rub some dirt on it, get up and get back in there.
Absolutely. And we have been building those levers so that we aren't, you know, dependent on any macro, whether for better or for worse. You know, it's really important to us to have those controls and those dials.
How hard, or why is it hard to get the right tech talent, particularly in an era when there's new types of tech talent demanded, I would imagine, across the marketplace?
I think there's two problems. One is there is a scarcity of certain types of skills. And certainly there's a scarcity of certain types of skills, specifically in the places where people are typically accustomed to looking. So what we see a lot when we talk to our clients is they're looking in the same old places, but for new skill sets that don't exist in those places. So they keep going back to the well on like LinkedIn or ZipRecruiter or Monster, looking for people with fresh, current skill sets that just don't exist in those places. Whereas what we see in the freelance economy is these people move incredibly fast. They're skilled professionals dedicated to their areas of work. And they know if they're not current and up to date on the skill in their industry that is the most cutting edge, they are not putting food on the table today or tomorrow. And so a lot of people are not aware that the Upwork freelance marketplace has the type of skills and talent that is absolutely what they're looking for, because they're just not looking in the right place. They may not be looking on our platform yet. So there is a disconnect between people who are looking, you know, in their own backyards or in these kind of like outdated places for newer and up and coming skills. Also for newer generations of workers, because we've seen a huge shift generationally towards freelance work and out of kind of these traditional models with successive generations.
Particularly post or even during and post pandemic, right?
Absolutely. And it's sticking. I mean, it's not like there's been a, you know, backswell into full-time employment. The numbers are out. We have a report out recently, but the increase in freelancing participation rates, including Gen Z, where more than 40% are freelancing, it increases every year. And it's not, you know, this is an enduring trend. So I think probably in the wrong places, they don't know where to look, and they're using these old models, which just aren't a fit with where the current and up and coming skill classes of folks are.
I suppose if you wanted to go for the macro look at your company or your industry, you'd be short commercial real estate and long employment, you know, short-term employment marketplaces that give worker flexibility.
I think those would be good bets.
I can see which one you've taken here. What does your GSV per client tell me about your business?
You know, it continues to be extremely healthy, you know, close to $4,000 ish on an ongoing basis. And I'd say it really represents the fact that talent working with these clients are doing long-term, high-stakes, critical work for these folks. And they're building these relationships that last. You know, one of the key insights we've gotten from customer research in this area is clients tell us why they come back to Upwork and what makes Upwork distinct from anyone else who is in our space or pretends to be in our space is they find the same talent committed and available on our platform year in, year out. And so whether it's an ongoing relationship where they're, you know, continuously paying that person for work, or it's like, hey, they found Steve. Steve was awesome. Then their need for Steve dried up. And then they came back 6 months later. Steve was right there, ready to go again. And so the level of commitment and endurance in terms of what these relationships represent is extremely unique and different from, I think, how people often characterize or misunderstand what's happening on Upwork as like gig economy or short-term projects. That is not what's happening here. This is programmatic work that endures and is happening at scale, both one-to-one and many for companies.
Your fabulous PR team warned me, do not say the word gig economy.
See, I said
you
it
said it, not me.
Don't, because don't that's not. It's not.
So if that GSV number were to be doubled or halved, hypothetically, right? If it were double, would that reflect that you're getting a certain type of higher skilled, more expensive worker? And if it were, who's doing more hours? And if it were halved, would it suggest you're getting a more breadth of offerings where you've got everything from people designing business cards to people programming in Python and writing AI data center code? I don't know.
I mean, I think that's one possible outcome. I think what we have seen, what we do know about this business is it's extremely dynamic. We have a lot of predictability, and we have seen over time, generally this march upward in terms of both volume, more and more customers being served. You know, we had an all-time high, 851,000 clients active last year. Also GSV per client generally on an upward trend. So your thesis that, you know, a bigger number there does represent bigger, more valuable work. Yes. I will also say, however, that this is a tectonic time in terms of reshaping work. I believe we're living through the renaissance of work. What gets automated? What is human? Like, this is all up for change. And what we're seeing on our platform is even in categories where there's more automation happening and has been for years, things like translation, the value of the contracts that are continuing in those categories is actually moving up materially and offsetting declines in spend because of the automation side. So I would say it would be foolish for me to say, like, I have a crystal ball on the future of how this all plays out perfectly. But what we do see already is, to your point, values continuing to increase, even as automation is happening in some places, fascinatingly. And as we ourselves continue to offer AI-based solutions for customers, our goal is to capture all of that, to capture both the increased value of human work, which is going to continue to be at a premium in certain categories, absolutely for sure, and we see that, and to capture more and more share of what you might think of as like lower value or automated work that we can actually enable and deliver through our platform, because we have a bird's eye view on 125 categories, 10,000 skills, $4 billion of spend already, and we can serve our customers with the full spectrum of automated, human and machine together and machine. And so that's where we're going. That's what we're delivering. You know, we're building all these solutions because we are a tech company. We're not a staffing company.
Fascinating business. Hayden Brown, CEO of Upwork. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks so much.
And coming up next on The Drill Down, The Bite, one number that tells us a whole lot more.
The Drill Down is brought to you by Futurum Group, where analysts, researchers, advisors, content creators, and marketing experts help business leaders anticipate and understand shifts in their industries and build strategies to leverage disruptive innovation. With deep analysis, Futurum Group's extensive industry experience delivers reliable research and data, thought leadership, and actionable advice to help you with your strategy and go-to-market efforts. Futurum Group.
All right, we're back with The Bite, The Drill Down Bite, the one number that tells us a whole lot about Upwork. And Ben, that number is 17%.
17%.
17% is the increase in marketplace revenues on a year-over-year basis in the most recent quarter. I thought it was interesting on their corporate presentation. They put up two graphs. One had the marketplace revenues, and the other had their enterprise revenues, a much smaller business. They, of course, want that enterprise business to be a lot bigger. They want them both to be bigger, but I think enterprise business was the big hope for Upwork. On the marketplace business, they pointed out 17% increase in the columns above above the columns that showed the increase in marketplace revenues. But in the columns that showed the enterprise revenue, they didn't put any number up in terms of percentage change because it was down, actually, about 0.3%. But 17% in the marketplace revenue business does show they've got some strength right there. Right, thanks for listening to Futurum's The Drill Down. I'm Corey Johnson. Thank you, Ben Wilson. Appreciate your time. And of course, Ben's both our fabulous co-hosts and our editor extraordinaire. The Drill Down is a production of 6-5 Media.